Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Raven Real Steel. This is your girl, Radio. Let's start again. Good evening. This is Raven's Real Steel with your girl, Raven the Serial Poet, coming to bring to y'all night 13 of 31 Days of Horror. I mean, y'all have been truly showing your girl love, and I appreciate it. You know what I'm saying? Like, the vibes have been all good since day one. And I truly, truly, when I say I truly appreciate the love, I truly appreciate the love. I hope everybody's day was good. I don't know what's going on with my brain. I probably shouldn't have smoked before I started the show. But anyway, I hope everybody's day was good and that you set out to accomplish everything that you needed to accomplish for the day. But it is nighttime. It is time for you to make sure all doors are locked, windows are locked, you got your popcorn or whatever you want to snack on, your fucking blankets, and you cut it all up in the bed, whether you're by yourself or whether you're with your loved one. Make sure you cut it up, because these stories that's going to be hitting tonight, baby, you're going to get spine chilling, goosebumps, hair standing on end. You know, don't let it be raining outside. You're going to be checking, seeing who that is scratching at you when there's a tree branch. So, you know, just relax, lay back, and let me entertain y'all. So with that being said, if you want to call in, the number is 914-205-5813. That is 914-205-5813. Let's get into this first story.
So this, ladies and gentlemen, is how I ended up carrying a taser around with me in my purse. We're going back like 10 years here, but my first real job outside of helping with my mom and dad's home business was in the local Walmart. I was 18, super young and naive, but I was very, very proud of the financial independence that job bought me. At least, I was for the first few months or so until it turned into something of a nightmare for me. So as you can imagine, the Walmart team was pretty large, so you could be like weeks into working there and still not know everyone's name. That, and you're almost constantly meeting new people or completely new hires since the shift system gets moved around quite a lot. So I didn't meet this guy Craig until I was maybe 6 weeks into working there. He was about the same age as me, was a pretty nice guy, but most importantly, Craig had his own car which he drove to and from work almost every day. Then once in the break room, we're talking about this, and that's when I find out he just so happened to live in the same rough area as me. We happened to be on the same shift pattern at that time, so he asked if I wanted to get a ride home with him that evening after work. Of course, I agreed, as it'd be cheaper and easier and faster than having to ride the bus home. So for the next few weeks, Craig used to pick me up before work and drive me home after. And for the whole time, he was perfectly nice about the whole thing, and never once did he do anything remotely creepy, either on the drives or at work. He was pretty much the model employee, too, from the looks of things. All the other associates liked him, and the whole time I worked there, no one ever had a bad word to say about him. Only one night, after he drives me home and pulls up outside of my house, he asks me if we can talk about something. So I say sure, and ask him what's on his mind. Craig then asks if I had a boyfriend, and I immediately become uncomfortable. I've always been kind of shy about that sort of thing, and talking about romantic stuff directly just causes me to lock up and get really anxious. But I told him the truth, that no, I wasn't seeing anyone, but I'm dreading where the conversation is headed because as much as I enjoyed his company and thought he was very generous for driving me around so much, I just didn't like him like that. So then he asked me if I wanted to get coffee with him when we both had some time off. Again, I said sure, but stumbled around the words as I tried to make it as clear as possible that it would only be as friends, that it wouldn't be a date or anything like that. I honestly thought he would take it on the chin, like it was an awkward moment for us, but I never expected him to react the way he did. He starts telling me how much he liked me, and how he knew I liked him too, otherwise I wouldn't be spending so much time with him. I just sat there listening to him ramble on. He was delusional, and that's putting it nicely. He obviously saw something between us that just didn't exist. I apologized, like genuinely apology, and told him I didn't want to hurt his feelings, but that I just didn't see him as a romantic option for me. I told him I really appreciated the offer, that I was flattered, but that he really was just barking up the wrong tree. Then he locked the car doors. I can't even really describe how horrible I felt in that moment, how I had totally misjudged what kind of guy he was. I tried to open up the passenger door, but obviously it wouldn't open. And in a voice that I know was just racked with fear, I asked him to unlock the doors. He didn't say a word in response. He just gripped the steering wheel in anger for a minute or two as I kept asking him to unlock the door so I could get inside my house. I said I was sorry, over and over again, and begged him to just calm down and let me out. But he burst into some tirade about me wasting his time and taking advantage of him, that I had led him on and how wrong that was for me to do. He said that I owed him, and that's when he put his hand on my knee. I just froze. I didn't know what to do. I grew up something of an ugly duckling, and I honestly just didn't know how to deal with that kind of attention anyway, let alone when it was mixed with just complete and utter terror. But as his hand worked its way up my leg, I just kind of sprang into action, maybe from the adrenaline, maybe because I couldn't bear to go through what was about to happen next. I threw his hand off of me, got my phone out, and told him if he didn't let me go that I was going to call the cops. Then Craig actually tried to grab my phone out of my hand before I slapped him so hard that his teeth must have rattled in his head. But he wasn't quite ready to let me go just yet, not until he made it clear that no matter who I told about what happened that night, no one would believe me. That he would just deny and reflect everything until people thought that I was lying and manipulative. He told me I'd already tricked him into giving me a ride home like every night, and it wasn't a stretch for people to believe I was some crazy attention seeker either. and only then did he actually unlock the doors to his car to let me out. If that sort of thing happened to me today, I'd have put that idiot on blast. But back then, like I said before, I was super young and super naive, and I actually believed him when he said that no one would take my word for what had happened. I lasted like 2 more shifts at Walmart before I quit. That place was just poison to me after that. I got it into my head that Craig had told everyone what a terrible person I was. I know that sounds crazy, but that's honestly what I believed. I ended up working somewhere else part-time while I attended community college, then moved away from my hometown to pursue my degree. But before I did, I bought a taser, which I still keep in my purse at all times, because the next time I encounter a Craig who thinks they can treat women that way and get away with it, I promise you, they're going to get the literal shock of their life. Based in Richmond, Texas, 33-year-old Instagram influencer and freelance model, Janae Gagne, had the kind of lifestyle that many can only dream of having. Having amassed over 2 million followers on her various social media profiles, Gagne reportedly netted a 6-figure income as a result of her many sponsorship and endorsement deals. Using the pseudonym Mercedes Moore, Gagne's social media followers included the likes of Cardi B, Megan Thee Stallion, Snoop Dogg, and Meek Mill, meaning that by August of 2020, she was arguably one of the most famous social media influencers on the planet. Like many of her peers, being introduced to the website OnlyFans presented Gagne with a lucrative opportunity. Interact even more intimately with her gargantuan online following, whilst also opening up a potentially massive new revenue stream. But according to Janae's father, Mark, the titanic amount of attention she received brought just as many problems as it did benefits. We kept her real private. Not even some of her friends knew her real name. They just called her Mercedes. I moved my daughter into new apartments 3 times because of my insecurities, he said late last year. The sheer number of people following her online, it scared me, he continued. Some of them followed her because they admired her, loved her even, but some were crazy and obsessed. It was just obviously unhealthy. So at around 4 p.m. on Sunday, August 29th of 2020, when Mark Gagne hadn't heard from his daughter for almost 48 hours, he decided to stop by her home in Cortland Apartments to check on her. He pulled up, knocked on the door, but no one answered. Mark Gagne then pulled out his cell phone and gave his daughter a call, swearing he could almost hear it vibrating from somewhere inside. That's when he heard movement coming from inside the house. He hadn't heard from his daughter in days, and no one was answering the door to her apartment. So who was moving around inside? Mark Gagne said that he began to suspect something was horribly, horribly wrong. So in the next instant, he reeled back and sent his foot flying into the lock, kicking it open in one furious attempt. The sight that greeted him inside instantly broke his heart. There was his beloved daughter, lying lifeless at the bottom of the stairs. Her apartment had been completely trashed, and there appeared to be lipstick graffiti all over the walls of the apartment. Yet before he had a chance to read any of it, Mark Gagne heard a noise coming from upstairs. Mark says that in the heat of the moment, he thought his daughter might have fallen down the stairs and broken her neck. But hearing something coming from upstairs had him bolting up to that floor as fast as his legs could carry him. Only then did he see a man lying in a pool of his own blood, gurgling and choking with a knife stuck in his throat as the life slipped away from him. Mark demanded answers from the dying man, but it was too late. He passed away just moments after Janae's father had broken into her home. Yet in a disturbing twist of fate, Mark Gagne wouldn't be plagued by questions for very long, because after he called 911, he began to read some of the lipstick graffiti that had been scrawled on the walls. "I was used for money," read one piece. "I should have stayed in Florida," read another. The final piece Mark read was, "I wish I never loved her. Sorry to the landlord and the family." He couldn't bring himself to read any more. Although it appeared that his daughter's murderer had been scrawling over the walls for days, he'd summed up his feeling and motive in just a few short sentences, and to Mark, it only confirmed that his worst nightmares had come to life. Janae's killer turned out to be a 34-year-old Florida man by the name of Kevin Acorto, a man with such unhealthy obsession with Janae that he somehow managed to track her down and kill her, all before taking his own life. He did not have any kind of prior arrest record in his home state, but during the subsequent investigation, police tried to establish that he'd had any prior history of mental health issues. "I don't even know how he found her," Mark Gagne later said. "I guarded my daughter. I wouldn't even let her friends know where she lived. Police still don't know how or when he got to Texas. There's so much that's still a mystery." The news of her death was broke by a Canadian rapper, Tory Lanez, who paid tribute to her with a post that read, "Rest in peace, Queen." But few of the tributes seemed to address the causes of her death. "She was very cautious about her surroundings," Janae's mother, Janetta Grover, said. "But unfortunately, someone basically was stalking and killed my baby." It's irrefutably horrific and abhorrent that Kevin Acorto was able to track down and kill such an innocent young woman. But it's clear that Mark Gagne's fears were justified. No matter how much he tried to keep his daughter safe, the determination her stalkers showed in locating her significantly outweighed their efforts. And somehow, a man who wasn't exceptionally computer literate was about to somehow track down her home address. Some have speculated that Acorto somehow got hold of Janae's billing information and discovered her real name and address in that way. In which case, OnlyFans has a long way to go before it can truly secure its content creators' privacy and security. So maybe, until then, the risks of having an alluring online presence will outweigh any potential financial reward. First of all, let me say this is not an indictment of OnlyFans. If someone wants to profit from sharing pictures of themselves or their body, that's totally their right, and I respect that. I'm not casting judgments on anyone who chooses to do so. But let me be clear. OnlyFans just about ruined my life, and I've never even set up a profile. It all kicked off not long after I broke up with a guy I'd been dating for about 3 to 4 months. As a single mom, it's way harder to get dates than I'd like it to be, but at the same time, I totally understand why someone wouldn't want to raise a child that isn't theirs. I mean, I wish more guys would be open to it. It's not like I'd never have a kid with them too, but it's just a sad fact that it puts guys off when you've got a child from a prior relationship. So you can imagine how excited I was when I met Richard. It's not his real name, but I'd rather not attract his attention, thank you very much. Having a 6-year-old son didn't seem to bother him in the least bit, and he even asked a lot of questions about him. I found the whole thing so refreshing and mature that by the time Richard asked me out, I just about bit his arm off accepting the invite. But then the first red flag appeared when he started making comments about my son, calling him Daddy. That wasn't the red flag in and of itself. It was more his reactions when I told him, "No, my son has a dad, and I don't want him confused as he grows up." Richard didn't seem to respect that position whatsoever, and actually said some quite personal things regarding my tastes in men, as well as the integrity of my son's father. It's a complicated situation, I'll concede that, but Richard's take on the whole thing was frankly disgusting and misogynistic. But given that it was a very unusual setup, I didn't want to give up on him so quickly, not since guys like him seem to be so hard to come by. But then, after 2 months of clashing, not often, I should add, I had to face the music and accept that if there was a guy out there for me, it certainly wasn't him. I've dated guys for 18 months who took the breakup better than Richard. They're always rough, but I think if I actually told you what Richard did, you'd think that I was making this all up. Needless to say, his reaction totally justified my decisions to end things. End things, and that's exactly how I phrased it too. But that breakup was far from the end of my ordeal with Richard. And you know what? It's kind of my fault too. In fact, it's mostly my fault, because if I hadn't been so trusting, I wouldn't even be writing this right now. The one big mistake I made was trusting Richard to keep private certain pictures I'd sent him. I think I trusted him because, well, he sent me pictures of him too. I think that's why there's a lot less nude leaks than there are nudes, It's like Americans and the Russians in the 80s, mutually assured destruction. You release mine, well, I'll release yours. But after we broke up, I deleted all of his intimate pictures, and I was foolish enough to think that he'd also done the same. Because the next thing I know, I got a message from a friend of mine saying something like, "Oh, you have an OnlyFans. You go, girl." I had to ask her what OnlyFans was. I literally had no idea at the time. She replies like, "You're joking, right? Was this supposed to be a secret?" Immediately, I start Googling OnlyFans, and as you can imagine, I'm pretty shocked at what I see. The whole website is basically homemade lewd images, and for those that aren't familiar, and from what I could gather, the girls in question make quite a lot of money, too. I mean, I wouldn't say no to an extra $2,000 a month, but I hadn't set up a profile, had I? I asked my friend to send me anything she's found with my name on it, then what do you know? There's a freaking OnlyFans profile set up in my name, and the whole preview picture in the banner was a raunchy picture that I'd sent to Richard. The profile said, like, free to subscribe, so I made a dummy user account to sign up, only to discover that Richard must have uploaded about 10 different pictures I'd sent to him, all with these disgusting captions that I'd rather not repeat here. I was angry. So angry. But I didn't get scared until I saw that he'd put up my home address. My actual home address, apartment number, postcode, everything. It kicked in how much danger I was in, and I just burst into tears thinking that my own selfish actions had exposed my only son to danger. I know it was all Richard, and I know if he was just normal, then yeah, it wouldn't have happened. But I'm a mother. I should know better. I'm not some attention-seeking teenager anymore. I just wanted to feel wanted, though. Surely people can understand that. In the end, I managed to get the profile taken down, and I think OnlyFans and other sites like that now make you verify your identity so stuff like that can't happen again. But what if you manage to get a hold of a girl's ID or something? The system they have doesn't completely eliminate the chance of fake profiles being set up. Like I said at the start, I don't mean to judge anyone who wants to do that kind of thing. I just hope they have their safety and security in mind because, as I think we all know, there are some serious psychos out there.
Have you ever been in a position where you found yourself questioning everything you believed to be true? Perhaps it was something religious or political. Maybe someone you trusted did something to undermine your trust in them. Maybe someone close to you turned out to be a monster. When I was a sophomore in high school, my father began what we referred to as a project in our basement. He never specified what the project entailed, only that it was his business, and whatever went on down there was to be kept strictly confidential. He even soundproofed the basement walls, although I found it strange his business would require that level of privacy. I didn't push the issue. As for my social life, I had a small group of friends at school, some of whom were into all kinds of kinky, bizarre, and sometimes outright disgusting stuff. Typically, I tuned out whenever the subject of weird stuff came up, as I didn't spend much time on the internet. Typically, I would just look up NFL or NBA highlights, and social media sites like Twitter and Facebook never really appealed to me. One day, my friend Kevin brought up a subject that I had never considered before, and has come to haunt me ever since. Something he referred to as the dark web. What he described it was horrific. Hitmen advertisements and other crazy things. I'm not sure why, but his description of the dark web piqued my curiosity. Could such a messed up place truly exist on the internet? Kevin invited us over for the weekend so he could show us what he was talking about. We agreed to go over. Saturday came and Kevin had managed to hack into the dark web. It didn't take very long for the rest of us to see he was telling the truth. All the awful things he had described were on full display right now. It was nauseating to see. After about 20 minutes of scrolling down, Kevin came across a link to an untitled live stream. Out of curiosity, he clicked on the link. The screen changed to a pitch black screen. After a short time, we were greeted by a digital clock gradually counting down. When it reached zero, the numbers disappeared and the black screen remained. For the next 30 seconds or so, We heard a deep and raspy breathing sound. Eventually, a beam of light appeared, presumably from a flashlight, and illuminated some strange man wearing a hideous mask, a top hat, a suit, and a cape. I get it, it sounds fake, but this really happened. When he spoke, his voice was distorted, I'm guessing to help keep his identity hidden. He said, "Good evening, and thank you all for joining us. You all may call me Hawkins, and boy do we have a show for you tonight, a pair of helpless victims." With that, the rest of the screen became illuminated. We saw a small room and the walls painted red. On the back wall were two women, one very obese and the other one was in good shape, both of whom were trapped on the wall. Hawkins approached the obese woman and stroked her face very creepily. "Are you an ugly one, aren't you? Ugly creatures like you don't deserve to be here. The pretty ones do." He then glanced at the second one, the more attractive woman, and he said, "Am I right?" She didn't respond. "I have something special planned for you, sweetheart, but first, let us deal with the little ugly one." I began feeling nervous. I was hoping this was all just a strange act, but with everything we had been shown on the dark web so far, I wasn't too sure of that. Hawkins shouted for garden cheers. A pair of hands appeared from off the camera to give the masked man some garden cheers. He then approached the woman and pried the shears open. He said, "What a pity, if only you were better looking. I might not have to do this." With that, he began to do the unthinkable thing, and then all we heard were deafening screams. My friends and I all gasped in shock, and one of whom began to vomit. Then out of nowhere, this guy grabbed his chainsaw. I get it, this sounds over the top, but this is really what happened. I felt queasy at the moment of the chainsaw. After receiving the item, he used it. The obese woman passed out from shock, while the second woman was also beginning to sob in terror. Eventually, Hawkins shut off the chainsaw. He looked at the other woman and he yelled for a whip. The unseen assistant handed him a whip. He used it, and when he was done, the girl dropped to the floor very suddenly. It was at this point when Kevin noticed a chat box on the side. Most of the messages from viewers were expressing utter glee and satisfaction at the horrific sight. Outrage. Kevin typed into the chat box, "What the hell is wrong with you people? I warn you, the police will hear of this." Hawkins walked behind the woman, and suddenly, the anonymous assistant spoke up. He said, "Hey boss, check this message out." Hawkins pushed the woman over and walked to the webcam. "Oh, a tough guy, huh? Gonna call the cops on me, huh, Kevin?" It was like a ton of bricks were dropped on all of us. Did that man really just mention my friend's name? Suddenly, a box appeared containing his full name and address. Kevin was frozen in terror. "Whatever. I have all the information I need on you. It looks like I'll be seeing you soon." That's what Hawkins said. Hawkins walked away, back toward the woman. Kevin finally shut the computer off and curled up into a ball, shaking uncontrollably. The rest of our friends bailed, but I chose to stay behind, even though I was also frightened out of my wits. Fortunately, nothing happened that night, but Kevin didn't get any sleep at all. He was a nervous wreck for the next few days, unable to concentrate in class and staying quiet at the lunch table when he was normally a very talkative kid. Several weeks passed, and he began to mellow out and return to his old self. The situation on the dark web appeared to be over, until one Friday night, that is. I was watching the 10 o'clock news when a report broke out about a mass homicide that occurred a few miles away. I was shocked and horrified when I saw a reporter standing outside when I recognized Kevin's house. His mother, father, and both his siblings were found, and Kevin himself was reported missing. I woke up in the middle of the night to use the restroom when I saw my father reach the top of the staircase. His clothing was covered in dirt, which I found very odd. I asked him why he was up, and he told me that he was fixing a busted sprinkler with an attitude. I sighed, "Whatever, Dad." I did my business, and I went back to sleep. The next afternoon, my dad went out on a run. He went to go run some errands. While he was gone, I suddenly decided out of the blue to check out the basement. Looking back, I'm not sure why I picked this particular moment to check it out, but what the hell. I wanted to see what the secrecy was all about. I reached the bottom of the stairs and began checking out the basement. Nothing looked out of the ordinary from the last time I had set foot down here, aside from a few items being in a different place. And then I look underneath the staircase and notice something that definitely was not there before. It was a door. I walked to the door and I opened it. A light turned on automatically, and what I saw shook me to my very core. It was a small room with red walls and mounted cufflinks. In the corner, I saw blood-stained garden shears and a chainsaw. On the wall next to the door was a desk with a computer and webcam. I also saw the mask, the same mask worn by the man I only knew as Hawkins. I was standing in the same room where the awful live stream took place weeks earlier. I heard my father's voice shouting upstairs when he noticed the basement door was open. He came down cursing at me, but he stopped dead in his tracks when he saw me standing in the entry of his secret room and holding the mask. We stared at each other in an awkward silence for a long time. My father was arrested shortly after. He had soundproofed the walls to prevent the possibility of anyone's screams from being heard around the house. My friend Kevin and those two women from the live stream were buried in our backyard. Their bodies, or what was left of them, were laid on top of one another. I guess that explained my father's late night yard work. As to why he took the name Hawkins as his dark web identity, he confessed to murdering another man back in 1995. The man's name was Carl Hawkins. 5 years have passed since I discovered the truth about my father. I haven't paid him one visit in prison. Eventually, he will be executed by means of lethal injection. I wish I could say I'm saddened by this, but I'm not. He's still my father, after all, but it is what it is. Now I'm left to wonder whether he passed on some kind of bad seed to me. I fear that one day I will snap and become the same kind of monster that he had become. But I always wonder, who was the person holding the camera? There's no more dark web searching for me.
When the headline screamed, "Local man tortured in basement," I was naturally curious. Little did I know I would soon be in the same position, not a week later. According to the story, a group of home invaders had burst into a nearby jewel dealer's home to steal a stash of diamonds he was rumored to have on site. Having caught the dealer unaware, they demanded to know the location of said stash. The dealer, as it would turn out, truthfully told the gang no such jewel stash existed. What he did have was an empty safe in his bedroom closet. This revelation didn't make the group happy. They chose to disbelieve the homeowner, and for the next hour, the burglars took turns torturing him for the location of the non-existent stash. It would be the arrival of a nosy neighbor that would cause the thieves to scatter. But by this point, the homeowner was mere minutes from death had he not been rushed to the hospital. It was a harrowing story, to be sure, but never once had I ever thought that I was in any danger. The extent of my riches amassed to about $25,000 or so. This consisted of a 19th century gold and silver coin collection my father had left me. I had just had the collection appraised the year before. This is probably where I was chosen as a target. The appraiser offered me $10,000, but I kindly declined. The coin sat collecting dust in my floor safe after that. A week or more went by. I was loafing on my couch watching a movie. It was about 2 p.m. on a Saturday when a loud crashing sound came from the front door. I was so focused on the television I nearly jumped out of my skin, and I peeked around the corner in time to see three masked figures pouring one by one through my shattered door. They were surrounding me, guns raised, within a few seconds. I was told to get on my knees, and naturally I did. My heart was pounding and my mouth bone dry. Instead of shooting me, one of them demanded I give him the combination to my safe. This was the first moment that I realized who I was dealing with. I tried to play dumb. "There's no safe. Why would I have a safe?" I said. I know. My ability to lie is usually better, but I wasn't exactly prepared. The shortest of the group gave me a quick attitude correction with the barrel of his pistol. Still, my pride wouldn't allow me to tell. Actually, my pride and my love for my father, to be honest. I wouldn't be caught dead if I was going to let some thug steal his life's work. Had I been more clear-headed, I would have chosen a wiser path. To their credit, I was given plenty of opportunity to concede, but once they had me tied up, in the basement, they were all business. Even as they tightened the knots and applied the gag, I was convinced that it was all a fear tactic. Surely, after what happened to the jeweler, they wouldn't repeat their mistake. By God, was I wrong. Right out of the gate, my left hand was smashed with a hammer. The pain was unimaginable. My right was next. This was even worse, if that's possible. I was ready to tell anything at this point, but I'd angered them, and I was going to pay for it. My feet were next, then my knees. I was barely conscious now. Only then was I allowed to speak. While one guy was upstairs, the remaining two huddled in the corner, talking. I could imagine my fate was being discussed. I'd never seen their faces. There was no reason to add murder to their list of crimes, I thought. I knew this, but I was convinced that I'd see the morning. The next few hours were hazy. All the adrenaline had since worn off. Pain was coming in waves so severe I passed out more than once. Death would have been preferable, but due to some fortune, it never did. I can't tell you when the gang left. I wouldn't have known how long that I'd spent tied up, had not my son told me so later. Yes, my son. His stubbornness would be my savior, just as mine was almost my undoing. After multiple unanswered calls, he began to believe that I was dodging him. The young man drove 45 miles one way just to give me an earful. I thought I was dreaming. His voice echoed down the basement stairs, and I thought that I was hallucinating. It was the paramedics moving me that finally woke me up. For a split second, I believed them to actually be my captors. Their faces were bare, and I was sure death was coming. But my son calmly placed his hands on my shoulders and assured me that everything was over. It's probably clear what followed next. My time in the hospital extended a long period of time, with multiple surgeries, and the recovery after that was spent in various casts and a period of time even in a wheelchair. For the most part, I have completely healed. The cold and damp are a chore, but since I moved south, I experience that pain very rarely. As sad as it may sound, I harbor no lasting hatred of those thieves. They may have taken something valuable, but they gave me much more important things back. My life. Nonetheless, when I was notified of their arrest 7 months later, I was relieved. Only a small amount of the coin collection was reclaimed, most being fenced long ago. I was surprised to get any of it back at all. Presently, all of these gentlemen are guests of the correctional system, likely for the next 30 years or more. I briefly returned to work after my recovery, but had subsequently since retired. The majority of my days are now spent in leisurely pursuits like fishing and hunting. I learned an important lesson all those years ago. Life is a special yet fleeting thing. You should enjoy every day like it's your last. I'd gladly sacrifice a million coin collections for another day with those I love. Sorry, Dad, but I think you'd agree. Stay safe, everyone. In September of 2020, a 20-year-old Australian university student posted a harrowing personal account to the popular social media site Reddit. In it, she detailed the terrifying ordeal she'd been subjected to after posting intimate pictures of herself on a social media page known as OnlyFans, one involving obsessive stalking, internet loopholes, and ultimately, a clear and present threat to her life. Only through a completely anonymous throwaway account did she feel safe enough to share her story, adding that her local police force had finally taken action against the person responsible. But even then, the girl made it clear that her complaints should have been taken seriously long before she was in any imminent danger. According to the girl, the incidents all started after she moved back with her parents during the summer break. The girl was particularly excited to be home, as the family had just bought a new puppy. By all accounts, the girl was having a ball getting to know her new furry friend. But as anyone who's ever had a puppy will tell you, to say they can be erratic would be the understatement of the century. One night, the girl awoke to hear her puppy yelping at the back door. They were in the middle of potty training, but the pup didn't quite have the hang of it yet. So she climbed out of bed, put on her slippers, and went downstairs to let the dog out. She says it was as late as 2 a.m., and there didn't seem to be another soul around as she stepped down into the night. But she soon found that she wasn't entirely alone. "I saw this figure in a car," she said. "I could tell they were looking at me, but it was pitch black outside, and I couldn't make out their face. I felt a bit uneasy, but I didn't really think anything of it. Only when I go back inside, the car started up and followed me up my driveway." The terror of such an experience is undeniable, and even though the girl was so close to home, there's no denying that being out alone in the middle of the night made her very vulnerable indeed. "I was terrified," the girl added. "I sprinted back inside and locked the door, and kept an eye out for them in case they tried to break in. But as far as I know, they just backed out of our driveway and left." When she woke up the following morning, after a terrible night of restless sleep and deep concern, the girl found an envelope inside her parents' letterbox. The envelope contained not only $20 in cash, but also her OnlyFans username. "I thought long and hard about how he could have found my parents' address," the girl said, "and I worked out that the problems didn't start until I shared my Amazon wish list." OnlyFans and Amazon were both adamant that their security systems prevent leaks like that from taking place. However, it appeared that wasn't the issue, as third-party sellers are not bound to the same data protection laws as large multinational companies. Although she doesn't know for certain how her stalker got her address, the girl is 90% sure that they got in touch with a third-party seller and obtained her home address in that way. Whether it was money, coercion, or intimidation that caused the seller to give up the info is another question entirely, but the fact remains that it's the most likely of all explanations. After that, when I moved back to the college town where I was studying, I stopped posting content, the girl goes on to explain. But somehow my stalker still managed to track me down. The girl said she basically closed down her OnlyFans account and started a YouTube account because of how unsafe the former felt. Her first big blogging project was due to be a shopping trip to a local mall, but when she got to her car to depart for the day, she found it had been ransacked. "The vlogging camera was missing too," she said. "I know, it's my fault for leaving it in the car, but I was using it the night before, and since I lived in a gated area, I didn't think I would be unsafe." Yet she added that the camera was inside of her glove box and contained an SD card with unreleased photos and videos on it. It was almost like someone knew it was there. But as bad as that was, it only got weirder from there. She eventually contacted her building security personnel, asking if they could review security camera footage from the previous few nights. And it was through this that not only did she see a man break into her car and ignore other cars in the parking lot, but she also had proof she was being deliberately singled out for targeted harassment. "After they got the camera, they walked around the duplex until stopping near my window," the girl wrote. "My bedroom faces an outside street and the blinds are broken, so it's very easy to see in. I have a curtain, but it doesn't cover my window all the way. Look, what I'm trying to say is, this person watched me sleep for an hour or so. I have no idea why they didn't try to break in, but thank God they didn't." The woman explained her camera was later recovered at a nearby secondhand store, suggesting whoever is stalking her has a prior history of criminality. However, she added that the camera's memory card was missing. "I know he kept it as some kind of trophy. I just know it," she added, and has since moved and hopes her stalker hasn't followed. "I believe the police are still trying to track them down, but I have broken my lease and moved to a new place, so hopefully this will keep me safe." But what's so scary about the girl's story is that it seems like only a matter of time before the stalker decides to take things further. Unless they're caught, stalkers will only ever escalate their activities until their obsession reaches a deadly and permanent end. I've been shopping at Walmart for pretty much my entire life, Like even when I was a kid, I'd go along with my single mom on trips down to the supercenter like once or twice a week. So as you can imagine, I've seen my fair share of weird and scary stuff go down there, from associates having straight-up fistfights in the parking lot to people going to the bathroom in the aisles. But one single incident stands head and shoulders above the rest for me as the most terrifying thing that ever happened to me at a Walmart. Like my mom before me, I too became a mother at quite a young age. It started as a stupid mistake at a college party where a broken condom turned into me having to consider terminating, but I decided to keep the baby and it was the best decision I'd ever made. With my mom's child care and financial help, I could still continue my studies and now I have a wonderful young son that I consider an absolute blessing. If I could go back and live my whole life again, I wouldn't change a single thing. Then, in 2016, something happened that rocked the small town I live in. A kid went missing from their elementary school. Teachers saw the kid leaving hand in hand with a woman they recognized as not being the child's mother, but didn't report it, assuming the woman was a nanny or something. Missing posters went up all over town. Vigils were held. The mom made a tearful appearance on TV begging for anyone with information regarding her kid's whereabouts to please come forward, but no one did. A week later, the kid's body was found buried in a shallow grave over in some woodland just outside of town. The entire population went into mourning. It was absolutely horrendous, and I considered just how easily it could have been my kid that just up and disappeared, only to turn up dead a short time later. No arrests were made either. Local sheriffs urged us to report any suspicious behavior to them immediately. I remember they even listed little things that we should consider as suspicious, such as a guy shaving who normally maintained a beard, people parking their cars in garages who normally parked in the street. For all intents and purposes, the killer was still at large, and the whole town was rife with paranoia. A few weeks later, I took my son down to the local Walmart with me to do some shopping. My mom wasn't always available to babysit, and this was back when I couldn't always afford a sitter to look after him, so I had very little choice other than to take him down there with me. This was at a time when he was way too big for the baby seats they have in the shopping carts, so I had to just keep him by my side as I wheeled the cart around to get the grocery shopping done. Now, if there are any parents reading this, you'll know of the pure nightmare that is passing the toy section in a store when you have a young child with you. It's like herding cats. They just run off all wild, and you pretty much have to just wait until their attention span dwindles before you can get them moving again. So I have to pretty much bargain with my son that if he's extra good and follows me around the store like a good boy, we'll go back to the toy section when we're all done and I'll buy him something. He smiles and agrees, and we're back on our way again. About 10 minutes later, after making sure he's been close behind the entire time, I turn around and find that my son is nowhere to be seen. I retrace my steps, calling his name, expecting him to just be around the corner in the previous aisle, having gotten distracted by some colorful label or something, but he's nowhere to be found. I then start wheeling down the center aisle, looking left and right in the hopes that I'd spot him somewhere, but again, nothing. This is about the time I go into full-on panic mode. I remember just how easily it had been for the person that abducted the murdered child to just take them by the hand and walk them to their doom. I had images flashing in my mind of someone leading my son out of the store into the parking lot and into a waiting van where he would be driven off and subjected to God knows what before they ended his young life. I abandon my shopping cart and start basically running around the store asking if everyone had seen a little boy wearing a blue sweater, which is what he was wearing at the time, walking by himself or with another person. Each of them says no, but each also knew why I was asking, and given the recent events that were now haunting the town, the look of panic and fear in their eyes when I asked them if they'd seen my son, well, that was enough to have me almost hysterical with panic. I was in floods of tears by the time I made it over to customer services. I could barely calm myself down to tell them what the situation was, realizing that my inability to properly communicate what the problem was only meant that more valuable time was being wasted when I needed my son found alive and well as quickly as possible. I managed to take a few breaths in the end and get it out that I had lost my son somewhere in the aisles. God bless those folks behind the counter because they knew immediately what to do. put an announcement over the loudspeakers in the store that if any associate saw a kid in a blue sweater, that they were to escort them to customer service as soon as possible. Minutes went by and nothing happened, and I was just convinced my kid was gone for good. I can't even put into words how intense and painful that kind of feeling was, how I felt like a terrible mother, and it was just going to be me crying on TV and having journalists banging on my door after countless hours of police interviews, and all that would come with being the parent of a missing child. But then, out of nowhere, I heard a voice cut through the maelstrom of panic in my head. "Hey lady, is this your kid?" I look up, and there's this guy holding my son's hand, who was silently sobbing as he walked towards the customer service counter. I've never been so singularly and absolutely relieved in my entire life. Like I felt it wash over me in waves, and I rushed over to my son and took him up in my arms. And we cried together for a few minutes, and I was too happy to even get mad at him for wandering off, which is apparently what he'd done. Wandered off to go looking for the toy section since he was bored, which also happened to be the one place I'd failed to look in my abject panic. Then he'd panicked when he'd gone to try and find me again and gotten lost near the auto parts since we basically never went near that end of the store. I then wildly and profusely thanked the guy who'd found him for bringing him over to the customer service area, even trying to give him all the cash I had in my purse as a reward. Naturally, he refused to take it, saying it was the least he could do, given the recent incident, tragic events that had touched everyone in the worst way possible. I was just a wreck by that point, apologizing to pretty much everyone for making such a scene and being a bad mom. But the workers there were just amazing, even asking if the abandoned cart near the frozen food section was mine, and if I wanted them to bag all the groceries up before helping me take them to my car. I honestly don't know what I would have done without their kindness that day, and I cannot thank them enough for taking care of us. But yeah, that was without a doubt the scariest thing I've ever experienced in a Walmart, and probably in my entire life, too. Just typing it all out is giving me the jitters just remembering what an absolutely terrifying experience it was, thinking I'd lost my son like that, especially given that there was an actual child predator on the loose at that time. I'm sorry if this got so long or rambly at points. I'm honestly not much of a writer, I don't think. Just please, if you take away anything at all from this, it's that I'm begging you. Keep an eye on your kids at all times. There are some truly evil people out there in the world. For the last few days, I've been reading about various Reddit members' run-ins with creepers, stalkers, and other downright freaky people. Now that I've gotten good and inspired, I figured I'd add my story to the list. This starts about 5 years ago. My family, consisting of myself, my brother Alec, and of course my mom, were moving around a lot. At this time, my mom was having a hard time finding a full-time job that paid well. On several occasions, we'd been forced to move out in the middle of the night. This would all change when she got on at a well-known lock manufacturer just a city over. The company even provided her with the money to rent a house near the factory, and things were starting to look up for sure. The move proved to be unremarkable, as was our first few weeks in the new place. Despite being nothing special, it was almost paradise to us kids. The neighborhood was a regular working-class area loaded with other kids and plenty of things to keep us busy. Ever since our dad passed when I was about 10, life had been pretty touch and go. But now it was almost like things used to be, at least for a while. During this time, we all did our usual stuff. Mom worked as much as possible, and Alec and I attended school. Then, we started hearing noises. I was the last to notice them. I think Alec mentioned them once, but I wrote them off as nothing. Mom hadn't bothered to say anything for a few days, but one morning at breakfast, we all heard it together. This one resembled a ring chime on a phone. It only happened twice that morning, one after another. We all three began comparing notes and were relieved to know we weren't the only persons hearing things. We agreed it was probably a bird outside. This was not the only sound we'd been noticing, but for the day, we put them out of our minds and began discussing more important goings-on. Nothing else of note would occur this day, but the idea had been brought up. We'd all be far more tuned in and probably wouldn't hesitate to mention anything new in the future. For the next few weeks, one of us would hear a bump on the floor or a scratching sound. We'd make a mental note of it and go on with what we were doing. On weekend mornings when we were all together, we'd mention the week's experiences. We even searched the house once and discovered a small hole leading into the attic. We figured a little critter was going in and out and making some of the sounds. There were still a few sounds that would have been impossible for a rat or squirrel to make. We thought we may have our answer, but some lingering doubts remained. The real trouble started when the food began disappearing. This part of the story affected me specifically. For as long as I can remember, I've had a problem with my weight. I've learned to control it in the years since, but my childhood was made very difficult because of it. This was made worse by my mom. She'd always been thin and beautiful and couldn't understand why I wasn't. When food began disappearing from the kitchen, she blamed it on me. This incident, in addition to a few others, damaged my relationship with my mom so badly, her and I still don't speak that often. But you aren't here to listen to my problems. You want to hear something scary, and that part comes next. I'd estimate we'd been living at the new house for around 5 months. Mom and I were barely speaking, and the noises were still an ongoing problem. We'd since decided the house was haunted. Almost a month after covering the hole in the attic and another leading into the basement, the sounds continued. What had once been a strange problem had become frustrating. We'd all had our own issues. Alec himself had been having breathing problems akin to chronic bronchitis. He just started his freshman year of high school and was playing in the school band. He had been up and down with his symptoms. On this particular week, he had been doing well enough to go on a trip out of town. Unfortunately, soon after arriving, his symptoms blew back up and he was sent home for treatment. He arrived back home in the middle of the day when my mom and I weren't around. Things were quiet at first, but soon he heard noises coming from the front bathroom. He called out, but no one answered. Not thinking anything was wrong, he went to the door and opened it. To his horror, a man he didn't know was standing half-dressed, staring at him. He said the man moved toward him. Believing he was going to be attacked, he fled from the house and ran to a neighbor's residence for help. This was where he stayed until the cops completed their search. What they discovered would destroy our newfound sense of peace and cause long-term damage. When I arrived home, Mom was still speaking with the police. My confusion quickly gave way to terror after hearing their story. As they cleared the home, nothing appeared out of the ordinary. That was until they searched the basement. There they discovered a makeshift bedroll under the stairs, hidden behind a large stack of boxes. Although the intruder was gone from what they found, it looked as if though he had been sleeping there for some time. I felt like I had been kicked in the stomach, and I became slightly hysterical for a moment. Once I'd gotten myself composed, I asked about Alec. He was still across the streets and refused to return home. His hands were shaking and sweat was pouring down his face. A few hours passed and the authorities had all they needed for the time being. We all returned to the house in a vain attempt to move on. The side effects began to show themselves almost immediately. Alec was eventually convinced to return, but he was never the same. Nightmares became a nightly occurrence. He was unable to sleep until Mom or I showed him the basement was empty. Worst of all, his breathing trouble grew worse by the day, and I too was greatly affected. Every minute inside the house made my skin crawl. As for Mom, she said nothing, but the strain showed on her face. Her sleep, too, had obviously been hindered. With no news of an arrest, we were all drowning in fear. We did all we could think of to comfort each other, but it didn't do any good. At the end of the 7th month, we moved into a new place. This was a 3-bedroom condo without an attic or basement, and I remained there for another 2 years before getting my own place across town. I've been here ever since. After moving from the house, it seems all of our lives have improved. I'm fit, happy, and in a loving relationship. My mom found love with a gentleman from work and they married a year ago. Even poor Alec is doing well. His breathing problems slowly disappeared after the move. Doctors would discover his problems were likely related to the massive amounts of black mold we had been inhaling. After the diagnosis was made, the health department contacted the landlord only to discover the house had been demolished soon after we left. I see this as an admission of guilt. Alex's night terrors gradually lessen with the passage of time, and from what he tells us, he rarely thinks about the incident anymore. I'm not sure he's being totally truthful, but I'm happy to hear it nonetheless. The intruder is still on the loose, as far as I know. He's not even been identified. We'll probably never know the full story. He could have gotten in through an unlocked door or a window. At that point, he could have had a key made for the back door. Our big ring of keys that hung on a hook next to the kitchen wouldn't be hard to find. And from then on, he'd have free rein over the house during the weekdays. He more than likely heard us discuss our plans from his cubby in the basement. And that idea still gives me shivers. He'd be content in knowing when he would come and go safely without fear of being caught. That was until Alec arrived home unexpected. I suppose it's no longer important if he was arrested for his crime. All three of us have moved past the experience for the most part. Any long-term effects have dulled with time. A small thing does arise, however. I do wonder if our intruder has moved on to another basement. It's a part of the home most of us spend little to no time in. Perhaps you reading this are one of these people. Can you be so sure no one is lurking undetected below you, listening to your every word and move? Maybe you should go check, just to be sure.
I'm from the Netherlands, and last year, my friends and I were having a party. I use the word party very loosely. It was just a few stupid 18-year-old dudes getting drunk at one of our friends' places. His family's rich, lived in the rice spike, and had a house with a good-sized garden. So, when we were hanging at this guy's place, we always had a blast. Eric, the guy whose place we were hanging at, suggested that we explore the deep web together. He had downloaded Tor, and had been looking around on it for the past couple of days, and figured it would be fun, just for laughs. Most of us hadn't even heard of the deep web before, so when he explained to us what it was, our drunken asses were totally in. So he shows us all of the common sites that you've probably heard of. After a while, we started going off-road, and looking for some obscure, crazy things. We found people selling drugs, a bunch of those hitmen services which look pretty fake, even a site where you could have a box full of actual shit mailed to someone. That one was particularly funny at the time. Still sort of is. We came across a site in Dutch that was selling animals. Not crazy, exotic animals, but like cats and dogs. Okay, that's pretty weird. Why would you need to be selling such normal pets on the deep web? We were about to click off and find something more interesting, when a chat box popped up on the screen, asking us what sort of animal we were looking for, and if we needed any help. Drunk off our asses, we decided to play along with this random guy who must have run the site, and since he sold dogs, we typed to him in English, "Can you send a bunch of bitches around to my place ASAP?" Our country is highly proficient in English, so he definitely understood our innuendo. He told us to stop wasting his time and to get off the site. We decided to ask a legitimate question. Why are you selling cats and dogs on the deep web? The guy's response really surprised us, as we didn't see it coming. He told us that all of the pets for sale on the site were stolen from their previous owners and then sold on for profit. The guys behind the site would go around to people's houses, wait for their dogs to be let out into the yard, steal their designer pets, and then sell them at a major discount. We asked him why he did it, and he said it was surprisingly lucrative. Since some breeds can be really expensive and sought after, there was a lot of demand. They also stole cats, which he said were much easier to get a hold of, since owners kept much less of an eye on them. What was our response to this? Well, we were drunk, so we started calling him an arsehole. He didn't respond well to this, calling us pussies and saying we'd never say such a thing to his face. He wasn't eloquent or anything. He just typed like some sort of thug. At one point, Eric, who was typing, was saying that if the guy had any pets of his own, he would realize how messed up what he was doing was, and that he'd fuck up anyone he caught trying to steal his cat. There was a slight pause before the guy simply replied, "Okay, I'm coming to get it, and you won't catch me." Bullshit, we all thought. Firstly, what are the frigging odds that this jerk-off would ever do anything? On top of that, what are the odds that he even lives close by enough for it to be worth his while? So we figured, screw it. We kept berating him and calling him an asshole in a variety of ways. After a while, he stopped responding with his empty threats, and just went silent. We kept typing, but since he wasn't responding anymore, we got bored quickly. A week or so passed, and I get a call from Eric that chilled me to the damn bone. Turns out that the guy's threats weren't so empty after all. His mum had gone to let the family cat, Cubus, into the house the night before, but it was nowhere to be seen. She figured that it just wanted to stay out for the night, so the family went to bed and thought no more about it. The next morning, when she opened the front door, right there on the doorstep was Cubus, almost totally skinned. It may have taken them a while longer to realize that the bloody mess was their cat, had the skin and fur of the tail not been left on as to help them identify it. The guy must have traced Eric's IP address, located his house, waited to find out which cat was his, and then caught it when no one else was watching. Maybe he was planning on stealing it, but figured that the breed wasn't worth taking, so he'd just send a message instead. We also don't know whether he really did live close by, or got someone else to do his dirty work. The thought of him living close by is pretty horrifying, as is the thought that he was watching Eric's house. Or at least someone was. We didn't fully realize who we were messing with. Sorry, Cubus.
I work at Walmart, and as many of you might know, a lot of our stores have associates managing the front entrance to ensure that all customers that enter the store are wearing masks. The order came into effect on July 20th, and all associates had to attend a mandatory training seminar, not only to educate them on the reasoning behind the decision, but also how to deal with any customers who refused to comply with the steps put in place to control the spread. Management also understood that since there was a lot of pushback with regards to mask wearing, it would be a high-pressure role, so a system was put in place whereby each shift would have a different associate working with the usual greeter, whose job was to enforce the new regulation. The way they put it, if someone refused to wear a mask when entering the store, it was the relevant associate's job to, quote, find a solution to the problem, which from what I understood was just a polite way of saying, either wear a mask in the store or get lost. We were even authorized to give out free masks to people to basically make it impossible to give us a I can't afford one excuse. So anyway, once the order was put in place, it only took a few days before it was my turn to man the front entrance. And I'll admit, I was kind of nervous about it, as I had already heard a few horror stories from other associates who'd gotten into arguments with irate Karens who screamed about infringing their rights and all that other stuff. But for the first few hours, everything was cool. Not a single person had a problem with putting a mask on, and those that had either forgotten to bring one or hadn't gotten word of the enforcement had absolutely no problem taking one of the free ones that we were instructed to give out. Then, just as I thought the whole thing was going to be much easier than first anticipated, I see this woman pushing a cart towards the front entrance who I could just tell was going to be a problem. If there's one thing working with the public had gotten me attuned to, it's that some people just give off a whole bunch of bad energy, and this woman was one of them. So, as you can guess, when I stop her and politely tell her that she needs to wear a mask to shop in our Walmart, she starts pushing back. After a few minutes of back and forth, with her getting increasingly confrontational and combative, she tried to straight up barge past me with her shopping cart. So unfortunately I had to call security to get her to leave. But before she does, she looks me dead in the eye and says, "You're gonna be sorry for this, young man. You just wait and see." I figured she was going to attempt to make a complaint to corporate, and totally did not expect what happened next. Because not long after the Karen leaves, this other dude comes marching up to the front entrance, Only this guy is actually wearing a face covering. I didn't figure he was going to be a problem until it became obvious that he wasn't wearing a mask to stop the spread. He was wearing a mask because he didn't want to be identified when he pulled a knife out of his back pocket and put it right up to my throat. He starts growling all this stuff, how, "You think it's okay to treat women like that, huh?" And how, "Punks like you need to learn respect." Turns out it was Karen's husband, who she'd evidently unleashed on me because I disrespected her or whatever. Dude, feeling the cold metal of that blade against my throat, I can't even tell you how scary that was for me. Everything just kind of slowed down while I waited for him to take it away. I mean, I didn't really think he was going to do anything. There were so many witnesses around and stuff, but Jesus, there is still that chance that he was crazy enough to actually do it, you know? He left long before the cops arrived to take statements, and as far as I know, they never found the guy to arrest him. This whole pandemic thing has been hard on all the associates. I mean, it's been tough on everyone, but I feel like for some people, it's driving them to the absolute breaking point. I'm just thankful that guy didn't have it in him to actually do anything, or I might not be around to be writing this right now. Be good to each other, people. Times are hard enough without us all getting all crazy on each other. It was approaching one of my niece's birthdays, and she's at the age where I think she would appreciate a gift from her uncle. I'm a poor college student with no car, so I commute everywhere and anywhere, knowing that I always take my backpack and headphones anytime I leave my house. So I'm at Walmart and have this care package planned out for my niece. She loves Elsa from Frozen, so I decided to get her a costume, doll, and candy, all Frozen-themed, of course. Like I mentioned earlier, any place I travel, I usually have my headphones in. This is kind of a pain to explain, but this detail defines the whole story. Now, I'm so lazy I use a third-party music app instead of the music app included on my iPhone. Unfortunately for me, this requires a good internet connection, and living in rural parts of Denver, my music ends up cutting in and out, and then stops playing altogether. Now, at this point, I have one item left on my list, and I'm in the toy section of Walmart looking for an Elsa toy. Before I know it, this mom leaves her two children beside me. I'm not sure why, but this has happened before. Maybe I have a trustworthy face. Let me tell you all something now. I'm not fucking stupid. There are so many strange things that happen in this world that I would be a fool to leave these two children alone. And for the record, I don't know these people at all. It's kind of a pain, but I figured it's just me being a good person. I don't even know how some people can do this. This is literally a woman leaving her two children at a section of the store and telling them to wait there for a short while. Anyways, one girl is around 4 years old and her sister was around 1 to 2 years old. These girls were fucking sitting ducks, man. The older sister had one missing croc and her younger sister had pajamas on and a pacifier in her mouth. I felt even more obligated to stay until their mom came back. And I was right. Not even 5 minutes passed since their mom left, and some fool came up and started talking to these girls. This tool said all the generic stuff any pedophile would say. "I have lots of toys and candy in my car, and a dog, too." I was like, is this guy fucking serious? He probably thought I wasn't listening because I had my headphones in. But like I said, by this point, my music had cut out a long time ago. As soon as he mentioned his dog, I immediately made my way up to him. He was crouched down talking to the girl about the stuffed animal she had in her hand. "My dog is really big. He's not pink, but he's nice. Would you like to come and meet him?" I crouched down and pushed the girl back a few steps. Immediately, the guy moved back a few steps himself. I extended my arm and shook my finger back and forth, gesturing to him. "No, not today." I gave the guy a very harsh look, like I knew exactly what he was doing. I just stared at him very attentively. The guy was very short in stature and had short, stringy hair with a tan pilot jacket. He was also wearing some very beat-up New Balance tennis shoes. He looked very plain, to describe him best. At this point, I was about to pounce on him and hold him down if need be. I'm not even a big guy myself, I just don't stand for any bullshit. Before that could happen, he immediately got up, turned right, and headed out the garden exit. I waited with the little girl and her sister until their mom came back. I said, "Yeah, you shouldn't leave your children alone. Some guy was talking to One Shoe over here about some generic bullshit, probably trying to kidnap your kids." Those were my exact words. I mean, there's no denying what just happened. Anyways, I told her she won't be as lucky next time. The mom just shook her head up and down and swallowed any spit that was in her mouth in a very harsh gulp. I don't know if something bad would have happened, but if my music had not stopped playing, let's just say neither one of those girls could speak for themselves.
There's a site on the deep web called the waiting room. All it is a constant live feed of a table. The live stream is in black and white, grainy, and from an elevated angle, similar to CCTV footage. Because of the way that the camera is focused on the table, it's difficult to tell what kind of room it is. It could be anywhere, from a basement to an abandoned hospital. I found the site about a year ago. The first time I went on it, there was a man, tightly bound to the table with straps. He was gagged and blindfolded. As crappy as the feed was, I could just about make out his chest rising and falling as he breathed, and his head wiggling around. He was hooked up to an intravenous drip. In the top right corner of the screen was a number, 104. I figured this whole thing was just a prank for deep web newbies, and that it was just some pre-filmed footage playing on a loop. I came back to the site 2 days later, and the first thing I noticed was that the number had changed. It now said 106. The position of the intravenous drip had shifted a little, and the guy was shifting his head and feet. The longer I watched, the more it became obvious that this was not pre-recorded footage. This was 100% live. At some point between the last time I was on the site and this time, somebody must have come in and changed the drip. They were keeping this guy alive, just tied to a table, unable to move, unable to see, unable to even scream for help. I checked back again at a later point, something like 3 months later. The site was still up, and the stream was still going. Only this time, it was a completely different person strapped to the table. A female, who, according to the number on the screen, had been in there a couple of weeks. She was wriggling around more than the male I had seen, still putting up a fight. After that, I had seen enough. One thing to note, though, is that in text, at the top of the site, the creator had said that they were hoping to expand and have multiple streams running at the same time. They weren't even charging people to view the footage. It's horrific to think that somewhere in the world, right now, there are people being trapped against their will, suffering in such a terrible way, unable to see anything, say anything, even move. It's difficult due to the quality of the stream to see if they had earbuds in, but for their sake, I hope they weren't forced to wear them. Complete sensory deprivation can drive a person insane. Never forget to be grateful for your freedom, and count yourself as one of the lucky ones.
I think I might be cheating with this one, because it's not even my story. There are no ghosts in it. No one gets shot or creeped on, but it's still one of the realest, scariest things I'd ever heard. So my brother is at this house-slash-birthday party where literally everyone is underage drinking. The party is on one of those cul-de-sac things, you know, like a dead-end street, but pretty. And what's also pretty frightening is that a buttload of people actually drove to the party and were planning on driving home. The house they were at had a thin driveway, so all the cars were packed into a bottleneck. The night wore on, and around 1 a.m, someone decided that they wanted to go home. They found the girl who owned the car at the front of the bottleneck and asked her to move her car so she could get out. She said she couldn't because she had a breathalyzer installed in her car and it wouldn't start until someone sober blew into it. They went around the party to try to find anyone who hadn't been drinking and couldn't find one. Another guy had the brilliant idea of asking the cool 20-something dude next door to do it. So an envoy of teens head over to the house next door and asked the dude living there if he could please blow into a breathalyzer so they could leave. The dude takes a minute to look the group over, takes a drag of his cigarette and says, "You're gonna give me $25 for every person at that party, or I'm calling the cops." The way my brother tells it, they actually thought the guy was joking, and a bunch of them just laugh it off before being like, "Oh really, help us out with this." But the guy was deadly serious, and reappears at the door moments later with his cordless phone, showing that he's ready to call the cops if they don't cough up the money. That dude must have gouged hundreds of dollars from them that night, as they were straight up terrified of getting caught drinking, especially the girl with the breathalyzer thing installed in the car. Like, I get that he was doing something wrong, but the whole reaching out to a stranger for help, and that's the way they act? Like, he could have just told them to get lost and call the cops anyway, but his first thought is, how can I make this work for me? Probably the worst birthday party my brother had ever been to. It seriously sucks that people like that exist.
I'm going to take you back a few years to when I was working at McDonald's. For context at the time, I was a 16-year-old female. Now at the McDonald's I worked at, when you are on headset, you answer people at the drive-thru. You are normally required to be at the first window to also take payment. My job position was customer care manager at the time, so my job was to be on the front desk, but 99% of the time, they required me to be behind tills. So I was having a normal day, working a long shift, but having a normal work day. I happened to be on headset, and first window that day too. My headset buzzes, letting me know there's someone at my drive-thru lane. I go through to the first window to answer my customer, and this is how the conversation ensued. "Hello, welcome to McDonald's, what can I get you?" "Oh wow, you got a beautiful voice." His voice was grunty and husky sounding. Not off-putting, we have all sorts of customers come through McDonald's every day, so it didn't give me the creeps or anything. "Thank you, sir, how very flattering. What can I get you?" "I haven't decided yet." There's a long pause here. "Can I come to the first window to decide? I want to see who I'm talking to." Now, we weren't very busy at this point. The creeper hadn't actually creeped me out. I mean, all he'd done was pay me a compliment, and we quite often had people complaining that they preferred face-to-face contact, so this certainly wasn't out of the blue or unusual. "Yeah, sure, sir, that's fine." "Wow, you're as beautiful as you sound." "Thank you, sir. Have you decided what you're going to order?" "Are you an option?" I laughed nervously at this. It was my first job, and I wasn't the rude kind of person where someone was paying me a compliment. I must also point out this guy must have been in at least his 60s. I remember he had one lazy eye that looked to the left, painfully awful teeth, and patchy dark brown hair. At this point, I was a little bit uncomfortable, but was still more than willing to take his order. "I'll have a cheeseburger." "Okay, sir, that'll be 99p. Are you paying cash or card?" Without answering my question, he started asking me where I'm from, how old I was, etc. But it wasn't until his last question that I got super weirded out. "What time do you finish work?" "7:30, why?" I didn't actually finish at 7:30, but 7:30 was the first number that came into my head when I blurted it out. I finished at 8 and would probably do some overtime too, but I wasn't about to let him know that. "I can meet you if you want. I can pick you up outside and we can go somewhere." All the while he's saying this, he has this horrendous grin on his face and keeps winking at me. "I'm really sorry, sir. I'm not allowed to meet customers outside of work. It's against employee policy." This was utter bull, but I needed him to leave me alone, and he carries on being insistent, but not getting the picture, and I cut the conversation short. "Anyway, sir, sorry to be rude, but can I have the 99p for your cheeseburger?" "Ah, yes, sorry. See you at 7:30. Off he drove to the next window and I was gobsmacked. I'd already said I wasn't going to see him. I was a little bit shocked, but was not going over there to give him the satisfaction of talking to me again. My co-worker came to me and said, "Ew, that guy had a major crush on you and wanted your number, but I didn't give it to him. He's old enough to be your dad, if not older." Anyway, I explained exactly what happened and how uncomfortable it made me. 7:30 came around and my co-workers spooked. The creeper was actually waiting in the car park for me, just like he said he would. He sat halfway down the car park, and you could see him just staring in. Our car park wasn't very big. It only had 4 rows of parking spaces, so he wasn't that far away, and would have clocked me the minute I walked out the door. At this point, I'm freaking out, and head to the back of the store where hopefully he can't see me. I had to stay in the back of the store for 40 minutes before we knew it was safe to come out. Fast forward a week and Creeper is back on drive-thru. And guess who's back on headset at window 1? Me. I heard his voice and recognized it straight away. I was hoping I'd hear your voice again. Why didn't you meet me the other day? One second, sir. I'll be with you in 1 second. I immediately handed my headset to my manager and gave him a quick briefing of the situation. He gladly took the headset and dealt with the customer from start to finish. When my manager came back to me to let me know he'd gone, he said the creeper had been asking my name, my address, and my surname. My manager said he was the most creepiest guy he'd ever met, and I was never to have anything to do with him again. If he came back to work while I was there afterwards, my manager would have to head me to the back room while he dealt with him. He still asked about me every time. So to the creepy McDonald's guy, let's never meet again.
When you think LinkedIn, it's probably the last place you expect guys to be sending creepy DMs to girls. But sadly, and sometimes scarily, it happens with alarming frequency. It's a problem that me and many other girls have experienced while using the platform. So for a couple of years, me and a group of like-minded people have been campaigning for social media platforms to improve their privacy systems, including blocking and reporting methods to ensure the safety of women and girls online. But all my campaigning has been promoted by a very close call of my own. I work in photography. It's been my passion ever since I was a little girl, and I managed to get my hands on my mom and dad's old Polaroid camera. The digital revolution only made it even easier for me to practice my vocation, and by the time you get to the Galaxy S21 Ultra, mine's charging on my desk next to me, you can do almost everything a professional photographer can do with a device that can fit into your pocket. But there's something very authentic and gratifying about the old-school darkroom processes, and it feels like you're birthing something special instead of just capturing a passing image. And although it's more expensive, I pride myself on offering my clients a choice of both. And a great way of me meeting new clients and potential employers is LinkedIn. It's honestly a great app, and I really do recommend it, but like I said, its user base contains just as many creeps as every other kind of social media. It might be a comment about what you're wearing in your profile picture, or asking, would you relocate for the right role, or the right man, winky face. Or in my case, it might be considerably more insidious and dangerous. Because one day I get a connect from a seemingly normal guy asking me if I'm interested in doing a photo shoot for him. I'm naturally a little bit skeptical, as he's being quite cagey about what the shoot entails, and the last time that happened, it turned out to be a couple wanting to take pictures of, you know. I give him my rate, and I tell him no nudity whatsoever. He then sheepishly mentions that some of the pictures would be topless, as they're for his wife, but promises no nudity or anything remotely sleazy. Handsome, but wholesome, I remember him saying. And, I don't know, the effort he was going into making his wife happy, that did seem super wholesome to me. I guess I let my feelings speak for me, but I accepted his offer and told him that we could meet at some studio space I had a share in downtown. Public, neutral ground, on-site security, safe. At least I figured it would be, because if I had had any inkling of what would be in store for me in that studio, I'd never have met that guy there that day. So, on the day in question, I met the guy at the studio space I mentioned. He looked kind of nerdy, curly brown hair, glasses, looking rather unassuming in his poorly fitted navy blue suit. He seemed really anxious too, like almost verging on innocent. He told me he'd never done anything like this before, and I really did believe him on that. Taking your clothes off for any reason can be very, very nerve-wracking, especially when the opposite gender is involved, which is half the reason I tend to avoid shoots like that. People's nerves are frayed around the edges, and it can make for a really bad atmosphere between you and the subject, which is the polar opposite of what makes a good photo shoot. But like I said, the fact this guy was really putting himself out there just to make his wife happy, God, I suppose that hit me right in the feels. I plugged the door code in, welcomed the guy inside the studio, and then asked him how he'd like to start. For example, if he might like a few professional-looking shots since he appeared to be in his work clothes. He says sure, and I try my usual technique of just chatting with the subjects while I'm shooting. This tends to make them feel at ease, and if you can coax a natural smile out of them and capture that on film, pure gold. They'll buy that shot every single time without fail. The shoot is going rather well. I'm getting absolutely no bad vibes off the guy, so I initiate a conversation about his wife that'll hopefully lead into some topless shots. At this point, I should really add that it was pure altruism that had me gunning for shirtless pictures, as I'm entitled to charge a premium for such shots, and the guy had agreed to that. If he turned out to be a creep, I could just avoid those kind of shots entirely, but since he'd yet to start acting weird, well, go figure. At first, the way he was talking about her was as sweet as I could imagine it would be. He was talking about how there was no one else in the world for him, that he'd known her for years before he'd finally decided to pluck up the courage to ask her out. He said she was everything to him, the first thing he thought about in the morning and the last thing he thought about at night. The only thing was, he didn't feel like he was man enough for her. He didn't feel like he projected the kind of masculinity she needed to stay interested in him. He'd said he'd been working out, watching his diet. He wanted her to find him sexy, not just cute, as he put it. And weirdly enough, I knew exactly what he was talking about, as it's something I feel like I've struggled with throughout my dating years. Sometimes you don't want to be mousy or adorable. You want to feel hot. You want people to burn for you. And with that in mind, I invited my subject to take his shirt off. The first thing I noticed was how true to his word he was about working out. I was shocked, but not entirely surprised. I mean, he had told me. But the thing that made me gasp was how his upper arms and torso were almost completely covered in tattoos, many of which looked like he'd done them himself. There was a handful of crudely inked pictograms depicting religious iconography from a variety of different Christian sects. But most of the tattoos were just short verses with markings underneath, and it was only when I looked through the lens of my camera that I realized that they were Bible verses. I'm almost completely stunned by what I'm looking at, but I do at least try throwing out a compliment, saying what you like about the presentation, the dedication to covering himself was admirable, to say the least. When I asked him which tattoos were his favorites, and that maybe I can work them into the composition, he pointed to one in particular. I had to look it up to get it exactly right, but it was this one, Genesis 2:24. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. He told me that's how he felt about his wife, that they were of one body and one flesh. But unlike before, when all of his romanticisms just came across as sweet and wholesome, I started to find his philosophy deeply disturbing. He started to flex, showing off his muscles, and trembling with raw power as he did so. I mean, he was ripped, frighteningly cut, only it wasn't attractive. It was starting to get scary. I started to get really nervous by the time he started to show off some rather weird-looking scars over where his heart was. At first, I thought it might have been chickenpox scars or something, albeit in a very localized place, I guess you could say. But he went on to tell me that he'd traveled over to Italy a few years prior to take part in a kind of religious flagellation ceremony where he and around 30 other men repeatedly stabbed themselves in the chest with a kind of needle comb. I don't have anything against organized religion as such. People are free to practice whatever they want, in my mind. But someone who hurts themselves because of how much they love God? I don't know. That just doesn't sit right with me. If there is a God, I don't think they'd want their children hurting themselves. Yet the thing that actually terrified me of the guy, not just nervous or cautious or whatever, was what he said towards the end of the photo shoot. I decided to ask him about his wife a bit more, just to kind of get him out of such an aggressive macho headspace. And that's when he started to giggle. I can barely describe how horrifying it was to hear such a childish, infantile giggle come out of such a monstrous form. And the more he talked, the more I realized something about his wife, and that's that he didn't seem to know all that much about her, only that he was counting on her being impressed by his topless photos, which by that point were far creepier than they were alluring. I wrapped the photo shoot up as quickly as I could after that. As much as they'd come on slowly, I never felt such a threatening aura come off of the subject in all the years as a photographer. He paid on time, left me a positive recommendation, and after that, I told myself I'd never have to deal with him ever again. But it was only later that I realized something truly terrifying about the guy, or rather, call it less of a realization and more of a theory. The way I see it, he didn't know much about his wife because they hadn't met. All he did know could have been gleaned from watching her, stalking her, and it makes me feel sick to my stomach thinking he might have used my pictures to, like, make a move on her or whatever. At least, that's the nightmare scenario that plays itself out every time I think about it. I just pray that, or maybe in this case, pray would be the wrong word to use. I just hope that I don't read about my subject in the paper or online, and a story about the latest young woman to fall victim to obsessive male violence. Whenever a large group of people are asked, "What are you most afraid of?" invariably somebody somewhere says, "Circus clowns." And sometimes that person is me. Most people's coulrophobia, that's fear of clowns to the uninitiated, is down to those Stephen King's It adaptations. Shout out to Tim Curry's miniseries. You see those spiky yellow teeth when you're a kid, all like, "Hiya, Georgie," and forget about it, traumatized for life. And I didn't see the miniseries until just before the movies came out a few years back, so I can't blame my fear. Some people just find them creepy in general, which, again, I understand. But I'm pretty sure I was chill with clowns until my cousin's 7th birthday party, when something happened that gave me a legit phobia that's lasted into my 30s. So, I'm like 5 years old, it's my cousin's 7th birthday party, and for some reason, he's obsessed with old-fashioned big-top circuses. I think it was maybe from watching Dumbo so much, but the point is, he's all about clowns, training lions, elephants, all that stuff. This gives his mom an idea to throw a circus-themed birthday party, which would include a visit from an actual real-life circus clown. From what I can remember, that party was awesome until the clown showed up. There was a bouncy house, snacks, party games, all that good stuff. But then after a while, the clown shows up. My cousin Jay is ecstatic because his mom managed to keep the whole thing a complete surprise. So he's about foaming at the mouth with how happy he is. Clown guy does balloon animals, all the clown cliches, and then for whatever reason, he starts looking for 2 volunteers. He obviously picks the birthday boy on the guidance of his mom, so he just happens to pick me too. And that's when he starts tickling me. I hate being tickled. Always have, probably always will. Not like most people who find it slightly unpleasant or, God forbid, those weird tickle fetishes who actually enjoy it. Nah, I legit hate being tickled, even back when I was 5. So the fact this clown dude is tickling me is already putting me on edge, and I don't want to ruin the fun, so I remember just kind of playfully pushing him away. But he wouldn't take the hint. He keeps tickling me and singing this dumb song like, "Tickle, tickle, tickle, tickle." And then right as I lose my temper, I turn to be like, "Get off me, clown dude." I just see blood pouring down his face from under his round red nose. His laughing in that super creepy high-pitched way actually tickling me, and there's blood running down his face. I scream like a little girl. I bolted towards the house, screaming and crying, running full pelt at the glass patio doors, which just so happened to be shut. And boom, I'm out like a light. I woke up in the car on the way to the hospital. It felt like I was out for hours, but from what my dad told me, it was more like a couple of minutes. Because I was 0 to 100 into those patio doors, I didn't remember getting knocked out, let alone how I'd been knocked out. All I knew was that it was the worst pain I'd ever been in, from a severely broken nose, and there was blood all over me, and my last clear memory of it being tickled by a bloody clown, or, as I remembered it, a monster trying to eat me. So as I woke up, I was inconsolable, and I don't think I calmed down until a nurse got some painkillers in me. Obviously, I didn't see the aftermath of getting knocked out, but apparently it was like a war zone. All the kids started screaming, some of them thinking the clown guy had somehow caused me to run into the glass doors. Spoilers, he had. Jay was angry that I'd ruined his birthday party, but that's just something we laugh about now. I guess I see the funny side myself these days, but that doesn't change what the event did to my psyche. It ingrained in me a deep-seated fear of clowns that caused some awkward moments in the years that followed. I'm not proud of it, but not 6 months after it happened, I actually peed my pants in the shopping mall when I saw a guy dressed up as Ronald McDonald. Like, I'm serious. It messed me up for a long time, and even today the image of a circus clown provokes a pretty visceral reaction in me, even if I have learned to suppress it. I'm proud to say I managed to sit through the It movie, the first one anyway, after working up to it with the old Tim Curry series, which I credit with actually helping me get on top of my phobia. But yeah, that's why I'm scared of clowns. For context, I am female and currently 21 years old, though at the time of this event I was 16 years old. I've never viewed myself as an attractive person. I've always been kind of chubby. I had bad acne in my teen years. I never cared at all what I wore, and I almost never wore makeup. I was an extremely awkward teen who had barely any friends and next to no self-esteem due to a very abusive relationship I had a few years prior, but that's a different story entirely. My point is that I was a completely different person during this time, and looking back, I know how naive I was and what I should have done instead to better protect myself. So it was the year 2015, and I was going on my very first cruise with my family. It was an 8 days, 7 nights cruise that was taking place a few days after a tsunami had passed nearby. After a rocky start, literally the boat rocked back and forth the first 2 days and everyone was miserable, and me suffering a slight panic attack during a routine evasion drill. I'm claustrophobic and really hate crowds. It ended up being one of the best weeks of my life, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself. Some of the downsides to this cruise was the fact that it was a North State cruise taking place in October, which meant chilly weather and no swimming, and because it was during a school year, I was the only guest my age on that cruise. The closest age to me, I think, was either 6 years old or 40 years old, so that kind of stunk, although I did end up crushing hard on our assistant dinner time waiter who was around 30 years old and had the sweetest smile I'd ever seen. Anyways, time to get to the meat of the story. So as far as I know, most cruises have at least one formal night where everyone dresses up really nice for dinner and they serve special meals like lobster, steak, etc. As I said before, I wasn't the most attractive person out there, but I did doll myself up for this special occasion. I wore a turquoise knee-length dress, tan-colored high heels, my mom curled my blonde hair, and I put on some makeup that really made my blue eyes pop. I honestly did feel kind of pretty that night. Dinner was amazing, and I finally got to try lobster tail for the first time. Loved it. I also, of course, made eyes and mildly flirted with our assistant waiter. I made him laugh because of how red my face would get whenever my dad called me out on it. So after our dinner, my family and I all decided to go our separate ways for the night. There was a bunch of events going on that each of us wanted to get to. Well, except for me, who spent most of the cruise finding random relaxing spots to sit and draw. I was, and have always been, an avid artist. So anyways, after a couple of hours, I decided I wanted to find my dad for some reason that I don't exactly remember. My mom had told me that he was going to the karaoke thing going on, so I started making my way around the ship, looking for wherever this was happening at. That's when I met him. I noticed him staring at me, and at first it was flattering. Like I said, I was average looking and had next to no self-esteem, so having anyone of the opposite sex look at me and smiling made me feel good. He looked to be not too much older than I was and was dressed in a cruise employee uniform, so I decided to approach him and ask if he knew where the karaoke room was. His smile never left as I asked him, and in a thick Indian accent he told me that he didn't know, but that we could search together for it. I thought it was a little weird at first that he was an employee but didn't know where an event was taking place, but I brushed it off and thought it was possible for some newer employees to not know where everything was yet. So he and I started walking around the ship together and casually chatted while doing so. He told me his name was Felix and was 21 years old. He also, as I suspected, did recently start working for this cruise liner a few months ago. For the record, I did find him kind of cute and liked how comfortable he felt talking to me about his life. As we continued walking around, he told me about how he was born and raised in India, how his family was kind of poor, how rooster fights were illegal back home, but he watched them anyways, and stuff like that. I enjoyed listening to his stories about life in a different country, considering I've never been anywhere but America at this point in my life. We had eventually stopped looking for my dad and were just walking and talking together. We were now standing outside on the deck and leaning against the railing. I admired how beautiful and ominous the dark water reflected the stars. It was as if we were floating in the galaxy. It was completely beautiful. He then started telling me how lonely he was and how hard it is working on a cruise ship and watching hundreds of couples being romantic together while he has no one. I told him that I understood how he felt because I was also single and hated feeling alone. He looked at me and told me he was surprised that I don't have a boyfriend because of how beautiful I was. I blushed and looked away as I told him that most guys back home don't look at me twice, and he was surprised by that. You know that feeling when someone or something is behind you, and you can't see it, but you know you can sense it's there? Well, I felt something behind my head, and when I turned around to find out what it was, before I realized what was happening, Felix's face was right in mine, and he planted an unexpected kiss on me. I pulled back in surprise, and he asked me what I thought about it. I stuttered nervously and tried to think of a reply. Now, yes, I was a naive young person who was always looking positively at people, but I wasn't completely stupid. This was a 21-year-old stranger who was flirting with a 16-year-old girl. I also had the sudden realization that no one knew where I was or who I was with. Before I could even say anything, Felix started telling me how he knew of a couple of spots on this ship where we could be alone to do things together. I started panicking and really wanted to get away from him. Now, another fault of mine is that I'm way too nice for my own good, and I'm always afraid of hurting people's feelings or coming across as a mean person, even when I'm clearly in a dangerous situation. I'm still too friendly to everyone now, but nowadays, I have much more of a backbone and wouldn't have a problem telling someone like Felix to kindly screw off. But as I said, I didn't have that confidence back then, and I had no clue how to get out of the situation. Felix put his arm around my waist and started guiding me toward one of the areas he was talking about. I started stuttering. Maybe we shouldn't. We just met, and we might get caught, and you'd be in trouble, and my father might be looking for me. I know that sounds dumb, but I was trying to make him think of ways where this could be bad for him, so it seemed like I was trying to look out for him. Don't judge me too harshly. He told me not to worry about it because people mess around with staff sometimes and their boss never finds out. That only made me panic even more. He leaned in for another kiss and I stupidly let him because I was scared of making him angry. After the long, uncomfortable kiss, I slightly turned away and told him I just wanted to keep looking at the night sky. He insisted that we should start messing around because we don't have much time together. I tried to hold back from crying at this point. And by the grace of the good Lord above, my phone suddenly made a noise and I noticed my father had texted me asking where I was. I tried to mask my relief, but I immediately told Felix that I had to get going because my dad was wondering where I was and that he was very protective of me. Felix showed his disappointment to me saying that, but then he asked me for my phone number. My heart sank, and I gave it to him. Again, stupid young female who doesn't know how to say no. I'm aware of how foolish that was. It was a good thing I didn't give him a fake, though, because he immediately texted my number to prove its authenticity. Once I thought he was satisfied, I started saying goodbye and walking away. He grabbed my wrists and spun me back toward him and asked for a hug goodbye first. I sheepishly agreed and gave him a light hug. I wanted to start crying when he squeezed me tight and pulled me against his groin and asked if I could feel it, if you know what I mean. I quickly stepped away and sped walked towards my hotel room. I made sure he didn't follow me, and once I was safely inside my room, I hopped on my bed and started crying. Of course, I couldn't tell my parents about this because I would be in trouble for putting myself in this situation, or so I thought. I promise my parents aren't really like that. I know now that in reality, my former Marine father would have tracked Felix down and let him know to never touch his daughter again. A few minutes into my cry, my phone vibrated with a text from an unknown number claiming it was Felix. I wanted to block him immediately, but again, stupidly, I was afraid that would anger him and he would somehow find me. So I answered him and we talked for a few minutes. We kept talking about how he wanted to see me again before I left the next day, which at this point I repeatedly thanked God for, and I kept telling him that it just wasn't possible because my parents didn't want me leaving my room for the rest of the night, which was a lie. I did eventually end up leaving my room and asked an older female employee where the karaoke event was, which she immediately took me to. Side note, the room was literally two hallways down from where I first found Felix, and I kicked myself for that later. I found my dad and didn't leave his side for the whole rest of the night. Luckily, I was able to enjoy the rest of my night dancing around with my father, and I did hide around him whenever I spotted Felix walking around, who was making it obvious that he was looking for me. I know the story isn't as scary as the most on here, but at the time, it was terrifying to me, and my own kindness could have got me into a very bad situation. The moral to my story is that everyone needs to be careful when going on cruises or other types of vacations. Just because someone wears an employee uniform doesn't mean they're trustworthy. There's many people out there who take advantage of kind people and want to use that against them. Just please make sure whoever you're with always knows where you are, and don't put yourself into risky situations. Two summers ago, I downloaded the dating app Hinge. I'd heard from friends that it was one of the better platforms for LGBT folks to find dates, so being a lesbian, I decided to give it a go. I found it to be just as good as my friends had mentioned, as the little prompts really give you an idea of what people are like before you actually connect with them. I hate to sound like this horror story is sponsored by Hinge and Raid Shadow Legends or something, but it really was refreshing to find a dating app that seemed to focus much more on personality than just a person's looks. Anyway, I'm just flicking through profiles, sending out the odd message here and there when I come across the profile of a girl called Amy. Amy was hotter than hot. She was literally my type too. Cropped dyed hair, sleeve tattoos, but a painfully adorable little face with these big, shining green eyes. On top of that, her job title said motorcycle mechanic. And there were legit photos of her working on old Harleys and whatnot, which, again, I thought was like the hottest thing ever. I double-tapped the picture of her working on the bike, typed in a message like, "This is so cool," and then just hoped and prayed that she'd be back in touch. It couldn't have been 20 minutes that passed before I got a little alert saying that Amy has invited you to start the conversation, or something like that. I'm thinking, no way. Is this a real profile? Sometimes a girl might take literally weeks to match with you, and here was Amy, hitting me up after less than an hour. I had my doubts, put it that way, but doubts that were quickly put to bed when she turned out to be charming, witty, and highly intelligent. We didn't always see eye to eye on certain issues, but the fact that she seemed reasonable and open to compromise was like the polar opposite of a red flag. It was like a blue flag or something. Something that screamed potentially wifey material over here. And as much as I tried not to hype the whole thing up, I was super excited to meet her to see if we had as much chemistry in person. So we arranged a meeting at a local coffee shop, nice and public for a first-time meeting. We're talking on Telegram by this point, too. So, she was able to send me a picture of the outfit she planned on wearing, just so I could recognize her. And oh my god, she looked gorgeous. I didn't think I could get any more nervous than I already was, but when I saw her in that flannel shirt with the sleeves rolled so her tats were showing, I swear I felt my blood pressure ramp up by 5 notches. Anyway, I take a few deep breaths, psych myself up to meet her, then head out of my apartment and around to the coffee place. Anyone who's been on a first date for the first time in a while will tell you how nerve-wracking it can be. Standing there, or sitting there, trying to look cool, while simultaneously being nervous as you're rubbernecking for any sign of your date. So, that's the kind of mood I'm in as I'm standing outside the coffee place, stewing in my own anxiety for 10 minutes, then 15, then 20. By the time I'd been waiting for a half hour, I was starting to get a little worried. Amy had mentioned that traffic was awful, so I figured she might be a few minutes late. But a whole half hour late? I was starting to think I was being stood up. I shoot Amy a text asking how far away she was. It takes a few minutes for her to see the message, but unlike her usual replies, which took a matter of minutes to type out, she doesn't send me anything. I figured that might be because she's driving, so I decide to give her a call just in case it's more convenient for her to talk that way. But again, there's no answer. I'm trying my best not to panic, telling myself, like, it's fine, she's just busy, don't freak out. But I think deep down, I knew it was all too good to be true. We'd matched too fast, she'd been too nice. I mean, she was objectively way out of my league. But it didn't make what came next any easier to deal with. I'm practically staring at our message thread on my phone, praying she'll either call or I get that little Amy is typing thing so I can at least know that she's still there. Then thank God, I see that little typing notification, and I feel this pure wave of relief wash over me, expecting her message to say something along the lines of, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry I'm late." But it didn't say that. It said something entirely different. And although I can't remember exactly what the message said, as I didn't exactly keep it around my inbox for long, it said something like this. Okay, I think this has gone on long enough, and I have to come clean. I'm not a lesbian. I'm not even a girl. Sorry to catfish you. I just thought you were hot and wanted to check you out in person. In person? What did they mean by in person? What followed was the most horrifying moment of revelation that I've ever experienced. Not only was Amy not real, or at least not the person I thought I was talking to, but the psycho creeper who got off on inconveniencing lesbians was actually there, somewhere not too far away, watching me. It made my skin crawl. I was angry, upset, confused, but the feeling that seemed to override all others was fear. The pure terror of being seen by someone or something that you can't see in turn. I start spinning around trying to find the creep staring at me, but no one seemed to be watching. Or if they were, they were certainly doing a great job of hiding it. Then, and I'm not even sure what compelled me to do this, but I started looking up. Now the coffee place I was standing outside was surrounded by tall buildings, possibly the reason my instincts were screaming like, up, up, up. I must have looked like I was losing my mind out there, spinning like a top with this terrified look on my face, but suddenly, I saw him. Standing about 5 stories up in a large open window was the figure of a man. He was so high up that I couldn't quite make out his face, but he was definitely holding something in his hand, and I'd be willing to bet my left arm that it was a freaking cell phone. I'm guessing most of the units were apartments, and they all had those large glass windows, but he was the only person I could see up there. It sure did look like he was staring down at me, but I mean, I didn't know for sure that he was staring at me. And then just when I figured I might just be imagining things and that there was no one actually watching me, just the sick troll that had tricked me into a fake date, he waved. The guy raised his hand and gives this slow, theatrical wave to make it perfectly clear that he was watching me. I swear to God, I nearly puked right there and then. I was this horrible combination of nauseous and numb, and I've never felt like I was about to pass out in my entire life, but I feel like I came close right then. My head was just spinning with this, like, this can't be happening. How could I be so dumb? No one that hot would ever like me. Of course it's a catfish. You're so stupid. Stupid, stupid, stupid. All I could do was just walk away with legs like jelly, wondering if I was going to scream or cry first. I've never felt so violated before, not without an actual crime being committed. I had zero recourse other than to report the catfish account, and no matter how upset I was, it wasn't like I could get the cops to arrest anyone over it. So yeah, I walked back to my apartment in a kind of daze, fell onto my mattress and just ugly cried into a pillow for like a half hour straight. It was seriously one of the worst days of my entire life, and it put me off dating apps for almost 2 whole years. Even now, I have to apologize when talking to girls because I know I sound overly paranoid asking for video dates or whatever. I guess I'm lucky, and I can kind of blame COVID, but honestly, I don't care how paranoid or overly cautious I might seem. After what I went through, I can assure you, you can never be too careful when it comes to meeting internet strangers.
I have been divorced for several years now, but not by choice. My now ex-wife, Julia, ended our marriage apparently out of the blue, citing claims of infidelity. There's just one problem. I never cheated on her. In fact, I was positively in love with her. My affections for her never dwindled in the least. I wasn't prone to spending a disproportionate amount of time at work or with friends, so I had given her no reason to think I was being unfaithful. Truthfully, she was a wolf in sheep's clothing. Unfortunately, it took a messy divorce for me to see her true colors. A divorce court judge believed her adultery allegations uncritically, giving her everything she needed to wreck me financially and leave me with nothing. I considered pursuing custody of our 2 children, but I dropped the case when she threatened to accuse me of child abuse and molestation. Once she made that threat, I knew I had no chance of winning. A family court judge would have believed her just as easily and unquestioningly as the divorce court judge. So now I'm living in a 2-room apartment, needing to work 2 jobs to make ends meet, thanks to alimony and child support payments. And I get to see my son and daughter every 3rd or 4th Saturday. And frankly, I'm fortunate it's even that frequent. She's interfered with my visitation rights multiple times with full backing of the courts, and I dare not protest should she try to play the molester card. Some months ago, she started allowing them to come over to my place every other weekend. That's when I began to notice some problems. My son had a bruise and cut on his arm. I asked him what happened, and he shrugged it off by saying that he got into a fight at school. The next time I saw them, my daughter also had a bruise, and she used the same excuse as my son. That's when I started to grow worried. Both of my kids getting into fights at school within a couple of weeks of each other. I mean, it's not impossible, but I never really bought it. Over the next few months, I began to notice other problems. Their clothing began to look worn and exceedingly dirty, and both of them had noticeably lost weight. This didn't make sense to me. My ex was getting more than enough money from me in terms of child support. There was no reason for my kids to be looking like this. I tried asking my son and daughter what was going on, but neither of them would say much. This raised some red flags. I couldn't afford a private investigator at that point. Unfortunately, a friend of mine who was far better off financially agreed to help me out. So I asked him to install a security camera for my apartment. When I asked why, I told him, "Something tells me I might be needing one soon." After a few weeks, the private detective met with me and my friend at my apartment, and the information he provided us was upsetting to say the least. He had numerous photographs of my ex meeting with shady characters in out-of-the-way places purchasing drugs. In some of the photos, my ex was shown walking out of shopping malls with new shoes and very expensive clothing. She had been using my child support checks for anything but supporting our children. The last two photos were taken from outside the house, and the detective got clear shots of my ex with raised fists while my children were in a defensive position and sobbing. So much for the claims that they were getting into fights at school. He told me one more thing, that my ex might have spotted him at one point, or may have noticed him a little earlier and got suspicious. He couldn't say for sure. Whatever the case, I had the dirt on this loathsome witch, and I was going to expose her. Later that same night, I was woken up by a persistent ringing on my doorbell. I stumbled to my front door and opened it up. It was my ex-wife. She looked like she was ready to shoot lasers from her eyes. If looks could kill, I would have died from a heart attack on the spot. But I kept my composure. What the hell do you want at this hour? You hired someone to follow me, didn't you? To take pictures of me? Oh, so you saw him, huh? I said, taking a measure of sadistic pleasure at making her realize she was screwed. What the hell'd you do that for? I had my reasons. Whatever the case, I've got the goods on you. Your ass is going to prison, and you're never going to be seeing the kids again, not if I have anything to say about it. She stood there silent for a few seconds, her rage seething. If I can't have them, neither will you. Suddenly she pulled a knife. I reacted a little too late, and she stabbed me in the shoulder. I stumbled back into my apartment with her trying to plunge the knife deeper. I shook her off, but she took a slashing motion and got me in the arm, leaving an ugly gash. I grabbed my living room lamp and tossed it at her. It struck her in the head, and she was out cold. The police arrived, and I told them everything. My ex had regained consciousness by the time and tried to play the victim, saying that I was being rough with her and she only stabbed me in self-defense. I told the cops I had a security camera, and it would prove my side of the story. I knew I had made the right call having it installed. My ex got a pretty hefty prison sentence, combining her illicit drug use, neglect, and physical abuse of the children, as well as her attempted murder of me. She would be old and gray by the time they let her out. I couldn't immediately take in my children due to previous financial ruin, but the court agreed to grant me full custody once I got back on my feet. For now, my kids are staying with my parents, but when the time comes, I look forward to rebuilding my relationship with them.
It all started with a Zoom call. At least, I only became aware it was happening because of a Zoom call. For all I know, it could have been happening for much longer, but the day of the second post-lockdown work meeting was the first time I noticed it. In the middle of a pretty tedious brainstorming session with a few members of marketing, when a coworker interrupts whoever's talking to address me by name, it actually made me jump at first. I was totally tuned out, so hearing my name brought me right back around again. I respond, "Huh? Yep, I was listening." When I notice the person who addressed me is now closely studying their own laptop screen. "I don't mean to alarm you," they said, "but I think someone's watching you through the window behind you." I know exactly which window he's talking about, so I turn, a bit nervous at the idea of discovering he's right, only to see that there's no one there. I'm more relieved than anything, to be honest. I figured he was playing a joke on me because he clocked that I was nodding off during the meeting, and I'd be lying if I said I didn't maybe deserve it a little bit. "Very funny," I said, and a few of the other callers had a little titter at the impromptu prank. "I'm sorry, but I wasn't joking," the guy said. "Did no one else see that? I'm so sure." "Hey, you're probably just seeing things," someone else chimed in, and within a few minutes, the whole thing was completely forgotten. A smudge on the screen, a bit of lag on the call, eyes playing tricks. There were 100 ways to explain it. The truth was literally unthinkable at that stage. A short while later, the exact same thing happens. The same guy interrupts, only far more urgently this time, saying, "Look, it's right there. I'm not imagining it. You can all see that, yeah? I know what he's talking about, only I don't turn around immediately. I look at my own webcam feed to see what he was talking about, and right when I see it, what's clearly the silhouette of a head in the window behind me, I hear one of the other callers say, like, "Oh, wow, I see it too." I spin around just in time to catch the quick blur of whoever was watching me, ducking out of view. I'm actually really creeped out at this point because it obviously wasn't just somebody walking past my ground floor bedroom. Someone had actually stopped to stare inside. My window isn't even facing the street. It's at the side of the apartment block, like you have to actually go out of your way to find it. Now, I'm only 5'3" and I'm 8 stone, which for any Americans reading this means I'm tiny. And I had to make sure if someone was actually creeping on me, they weren't just hiding out and waiting until I was vulnerable. So, phone in one hand, kitchen knife in the other, I tell the Zoom call that I'll be right back and then head out to make sure that everything is kosher. It's peak lockdown during all of this, so the streets are pretty much deserted, so I think I'd have noticed anyone wandering around. But there was no one, not a soul in sight. So I guessed, or rather hoped, that it was just some neighbor kids messing around, maybe looking for a wayward ball or something. About a week goes by, and the whole window face incident has been at the back of my mind the whole time. For a lot of young women who live alone, the idea of being targeted where we're most vulnerable is frankly terrifying. So the prospect of that nightmare coming to life just didn't bear thinking about. I'm not saying I was on edge the whole time or that I lose sleep over it or anything, but let's just say I held my keys a little tighter in my fists whenever I walked down the street my apartment block is on. But anyway, at one point I head out to the grocery store to pick up food, and I end up caught in one of those super long COVID lines that you're stuck in for like 40 minutes before you're allowed into the store to buy your stuff. This is on top of the fact that the store near me had implemented this dumb one-way system in the aisles in an attempt to stop the spread. My point is, a trip that would have normally taken like half hour ends up taking more like 90 minutes, and an annoying amount of my day has been completely wasted. So I'm already in a bad mood by the time I get back to my apartment, only to find that the front door has been bashed in. Apparently, there had been a break-in while I was out. If only criminals could work from home. It seemed obvious that it was a burglary at first. All my stuff had been strewn around. Drawers and cabinets were opened and emptied. The TV was still there, along with my PlayStation, but most break-ins just go for jewelry and phones, I heard. Anything small that they can pawn easily. Obviously, I called the cops like there and then, who arrived within a half hour or so. They advised me to help them look around the apartment for anything that might be missing, valuable electronics and whatnot, but I told them I already looked and that nothing obvious seemed to have been taken. My bedroom looked like it had been hit by a bomb. Clothes had been strewn all over the place. Whole drawers had been pulled out and flipped, like whoever broke in was looking for something. One of the cops spent some time looking around in there before he called out to his partner. "Hey, we need forensics up in here," is what he actually said. I asked him what the deal was, if he'd found something that I should know about. Both cops had been warm, friendly, and helpful up until that point. But when I asked him why forensics was needed, one of them told me not to worry about it and to stay out of my bedroom for the time being. It was no big deal at first. I was just grateful that they showed up so fast, even if they did wear masks and insist on keeping 6 feet between us at all times. So by the time forensics team showed up, I'm out front of my apartment building, talking to my mom on the phone. Only when I see what they're actually doing in my apartment, it triggers what I can only describe as a mini freakout. Guys in gloves and white coverall suits have been scooping big handfuls of my underwear into bags, sealing them, and taking them out to the truck outside. And then it dawns on me, whoever broke into my apartment had left DNA on my underwear. I probably don't need to tell you how exactly they'd done that. The whole thing grosses me out too much for me to actually type it. But the thing that really got to me was, if I'd actually been home that afternoon, there's no telling what would have happened if some violent perv had actually gotten their dirty hands on me. But anyway, the story does actually have something of a resolution and thankfully a happy ending, because they had this guy's DNA. Police were able to match it on their database with a guy who'd had multiple run-ins with the law for public exposure, among other things. He was arrested, and he's now looking at 3 years in prison for aggravated burglary, some kind of charge like that. But the whole thing came full circle for me in an interview with some detective who'd mentioned that this guy liked casing his victims' places before he struck. Over the past month or so, have you seen anyone hanging around your apartment who doesn't live there? Maybe someone looking through your window? He said it. He literally said it. It was him, that day when I was in the Zoom call. It was him that had been looking through my window. He'd been stalking me for God knows how long, and when it came for him to actually get me, only by the grace of God was I lucky enough to have been out grocery shopping. Otherwise, it doesn't bear thinking about what might have happened. In the weeks after the death of my brother, I found myself looking for comfort on the internet. Around 4 months had passed and I discovered a forum created for twins dealing with the grief of losing their other twin. Whether from ending their own life or illness, thousands across the world were brought together for this one singular purpose. I admit I was somewhat shy about posting and remained a bit of a lurker. However, as I became more comfortable with the community, I grew into a daily poster and was able to befriend many on the forum. A select few of these people and I became very close and did much to help one another to work through our grief. One member, a girl who said she was from Montana, probably did the most of all to help me move forward. She had lost her twin sister in a similar circumstance, just as I had my brother, and had a specific insight many others in the forum did not. It was not long until her and I were confessing our deepest secrets to each other, and it was very nearly as if I hadn't lost my twin at all. You may ask why I would tell a complete stranger all my deepest and darkest secrets. I suppose the anonymity was the reason. Even if the person knows or thinks they know all about you, they still don't know your true identity and location. That aspect of the internet gives you carte blanche to bare your soul to a person you're confident doesn't know the true you. The connection we formed over my time on the forum was the best thing that could have happened to me at the time. However, my confidence in my anonymity and comfort with this person would ultimately come back to bite me and make my life on the internet and outside of it complete torture. It was an average ordinary morning when I discovered my friend's true face. I fired up my computer and opened my mail only to be overwhelmed by a barrage of angry and vicious messages. As I scrolled through each one, it soon became clear what was happening. Someone very close to me had dumped all my terrible secrets onto the forum and wider internet. I tried to deny it to myself for a long time, who the identity of the person was, but I was eventually forced to face the facts. Apparently, my supposed friend on the forum had told everyone there some of my private feelings towards my dead brother and the way in which he chose to end his life. We all have those opinions or feelings we keep to ourselves because we know they wouldn't be popular with those around us. I never said anything terrible or anything like that, but most of my words surrounded my anger toward my twin. I probably could have phrased some of them better, but that's the fatal flaw of the internet. Without context or hearing the person's tone of voice, things can get lost or misconstrued. Over a short time, the situation would become far worse. The threatening messages started. People I had once called friends were now threatening my life. It wasn't just online, either. The messages were soon coming to my phone. This fact only proved to cement her guilt, since she was one of the very few who had my number. The most terrifying aspect of the phone messages was that many knew my real name and address. This was when I truly came to fear for my life. I'd become a bawling and panicking mess. When I would finally sum up the courage to confront her about this, the pieces would all begin to fall into place. Her written reply laid it all out clearly. I had foolishly walked right into the clutches of a person who hated me and my family. My friend, all these months, turned out to be the drug-addicted ex-girlfriend of my brother. In my opinion, she was one of the major reasons he took his life, and my family agreed, which is why we had barred her from the funeral and anything taking place that day. She swore she'd get back at us, and boy, she did. Apparently, she had been on the forum one day and guessed who I was. Just to be sure, she pretended to be a bereaved twin and started to suck up to me. Once it became obvious that I was who she thought I was, she saw it as an opportunity to get her revenge. In hindsight, things were starting to make more sense. She'd always been a bit pushy when trying to get me to tell her a secret. To make me more comfortable, she'd tell me something, which we all know now was a load of BS, and I would always fall for it. All through her message, it was clear she had no remorse for what she had done. In fact, upon hearing of the many threats in my life, she decided to push things along by doxing me. What she hoped to happen had, and she was very pleased by the result. This final message was the last time I'd heard from her. No replies would come to my following emails, and soon after, I'd be forced to get a new address. After I spoke with my family and our lawyer, I took their advice and got rid of all my prior connections. This included having to move to a new place. I was, and still am, concerned about the remainder of my family. Although my brother's ex was able to get her revenge on me, the rest of them were assumed to still be in danger. My father assured me that they would be fine, and from all appearances, he may be correct, at least for now. I had stepped away from the internet for almost 9 months, and am just now beginning to dip my foot back into the pool. Naturally, I will never return to the forum in which all these problems spawned. Even though I've not yet had any run-ins with anyone from there, I will never again expose myself to the level of being identified. Even the account from which this story has been sent is a one-time use throwaway. So if any of those coming across this story may have any questions, I'm sorry. None will be forthcoming anytime soon, and certainly not from this account. If there's anything you can take away from this mishap, perhaps it is a lesson of caution. I and many others have discovered to our detriment how big of a sewer the internet can be. Like the sewer, there lurk many rats. On the internet, the rats are waiting in hiding to destroy others. Many have no reasons. They're just evil. I suppose I'm trying to advise you all to be careful and remember that no one on the internet is really your friend unless you know them in real life. And although many perils linger there, the internet is not real life.
This was 3 years ago, and I started college down the country. I was 18 and on Tinder, and had never actually met anyone from it, but would just swipe through guys to be nosy and see who was on it. I was swiping right on some, and about a half hour after, got a message from this guy, who, according to his account, was roughly 20 kilometers away. We made some small talk, and it was awkward, and I stopped replying. A day later, I received a friend request for him from Facebook. Mind you, I have a common enough name, so it would have taken ages for him to find me. We had no mutual friends, and my Tinder photos are not on my Facebook page. The only thing I had on it was the university I was attending, so maybe that's how he found me, but I don't know. I then quickly got a follow request on Instagram, and he somehow found my Snapchat username. I don't even have my social media, and it's a variation of my full name with extra added vowels and an underscore. I was freaking out at this point. I messaged him asking how he found my full name, and he just replied, "I think we have a connection. I really want to get to know you better." I unmatched him, deleted my Tinder, and blocked the accounts he tried to add me on all social media. After that, it was quiet for a few months. I was staying in digs and was knuckling down as I had a lot of assignments from the get-go. This was towards the end of November. I had no assignments due for 2 weeks, so I decided to go out with some friends. One of my friends stayed in student accommodation and the other was commuting, so she was staying with the other friend. I decided to walk back to my digs, as my landlady would probably freak out if I wasn't home that morning, and I really wish I got a taxi instead. I walked back and was about 15 minutes from the local nightclub we were at. It was at 3 a.m., and I was at the front door of the house opening up. The door was annoying, as it had two different locks, and I had to pull the handle towards myself to help open it up. It's also tough when you're tipsy. and trying not to wake up the family you're staying with. As I finally unlock the door, a dark car pulls into the housing estate I'm staying in. It's quite big and has a big green area in the middle for children, or people playing with their dogs. The car comes towards me, so I quickly get inside and lock the door. The car pulls into the driveway of the house I'm staying in and just sits there with the full headlights on. I'm there shaking and too afraid to move from crouched below the door as there's frosted glass about halfway up. As I get the courage to go upstairs and look out my bedroom window to see who it is, the car pulls out the driveway and speeds off. A few days later, I get a new friend request off the creepy Tinder guy on a new Facebook profile. Even though there were no pictures on the account, just the same name, I blocked it. It was enough. It even caused me to transfer universities the next year. Thankfully, I haven't heard anything since. I don't know if it was just bad timing, or if it was that creep on Tinder that sat in the driveway, but it was petrifying. If you take anything from this, be careful who you let on social media or dating apps, and what information you have up.
Well, y'all, that is my time. I hope y'all enjoyed the show. I wanted to make a comment real quick before I completely log off. I don't know whether I have to say this every show or at the beginning or at the end of every show. These stories are on land from different places that I've heard them and things like that. I thought it would be a nice addition, especially since I'm doing 31 days of horror or whatnot. If you can't take the entertainment for what it is, trust and believe, I understand you don't have to listen. But I don't need you to inbox me every time you hear a story and be like, oh, well, I heard this story this way, I heard this story that way, this story sound like this, and whatever. If you can enjoy it as it comes, please, by all means, you know, you don't have to miss it. It's fine. It's totally fine. But to the ones who call in and enjoy the show, I want to say thank you, and I appreciate the love and the support. But before I get out of here, I just want to say meet me here, same time, same place, tomorrow. And I'm going to leave y'all with my thought of the night, and my thought of the night is, people who play roles will eventually forget their lines. So make sure you pay attention to those who are ad-libbing, because those are the ones that you have to watch out for the most. So with that being said, love, peace, and blessings. Pray before you lay. I love y'all, and good night.